Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell here with Russ Chianelli. We have a guest today who's from the DeBakey Center at the VA Medical Center in Houston. And just imagine this scenario for a moment. You go into the hospital, you've got a bit of a pain in your arm, and they look at it, and all of a sudden they say, this is an emergency. We've got to sort of dig out a long part of your arm. And you can then turn to somebody and say, but we need a replacement. And you say, what, right now? And they say, absolutely. This is called intraoperative intervention. This sounds like Star Wars or Star Trek to me, but Russ, who's this special guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Professor Michael Leibschner. Welcome, Michael, to Science Studio.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, no, this is going to be fun. I mean, it sounds like, you know, really futuristic, you know, having an immediate transplant available for anybody who walks in just like that. But before we get to that, well, let's talk about Michael. How did you become this engineer, scientist, medical practitioner, all these things rolled into one? Where did you begin this?
I actually started in Germany. I've got my education or bachelor in engineering, mechanical engineering in Germany, with the focus in automation engineering and design. And it was a big economic recess in Germany. Now it's about 15, 20 years ago. It was the first time in history that engineers were unemployed, especially mechanical engineers. And so I started looking in other areas that were looking for engineers and biomechanics. Applying engineering skills to the orthopedic fields or to the medical field was actually very interesting at that time.
What part of Germany were you doing this in?
That was in Bochum, which is like in the middle of the country. So I grew up in the Black Forest area, but then moved up north in Schwarzwald. Okay. That's where the Black Forest ham is coming from.
Right.
And the Black Forest cake, all that kind of good stuff.
And sort of grim fairy tales also,
yeah.
I guess.
And so basically I moved in up north, going to college, and that's where that happened. And then so I took elective courses in biomechanics, learned about the implants, hip implants, knee implants, how they are shaped, how they interact with the human body, how the body reacts to these type of implants, but from an engineering point of view, not from a medical point of view. And then I took an internship at the Moritz Müller Institute in Switzerland for biomechanics. They introduced me to what's called computer-assisted orthopedic surgery, or CAOS. And it's basically a kind of a computer game for physicians. So they can place implants very accurate on a patient by looking on a computer screen and basically navigating the instruments on a computer screen while they're doing the surgery on a patient. And I did my master's thesis in that institute.
So in that case, though, they'd have to have prefabricated the piece long before they implanted it.
At that point, it's like I said, it was about 15 years ago. There were no fabrication in a sense. They used the already available medical implants, titanium implants, screws and rods in place, and then put those in there with high certainty to prevent injuring the spinal cord or any type of major arteries. And then from there on, I basically got my PhD in Vermont, at the University of Vermont, in also mechanical engineering, but focused on biomechanics. And then from there on, basically.
So what made you decide to go from Germany to the U.S.? Was it economics or opportunities?
It was opportunity. In Germany, they're still very lagging behind in this area of biomechanics. There's not a single institute for biomechanics or biomedical engineering or like a department of biomedical engineering. There are certain research institutes that are founded by different members from different departments, but they don't educate their own students. There's not a degree in biomedical engineering.
Okay, so then tell us now a little bit about what you're doing down there at the DeBakey Center in the VA Center.
We started looking into fabricating artificial tissue or synthetic tissue, what's called a scaffold. And it's a temporary replacement of a tissue defect. So if you have a tumor taken out, you put this material in there, it's biodegradable. Over a year to 2 years, it dissipates, and it's supposedly replaced by native tissue. So you have a bone defect, you put this polymer in there, the polymer is degraded by the body, and it builds new bone tissue on its place.
So depending upon the tissue that you need, the different materials will have different properties. I mean, so something you put in for a bone replacement won't be the same as you put in for skin replacement, for
That's
example.
Correct, yeah. Yeah, so different properties for the different tissues.
You have to then interact very strongly with materials chemists, for example, in order to devise the correct polymer for the particular process that you need to use.
It's actually the other way around. Our chemists kind of started this field, and trying to develop polymers that replicate bone tissue, that replicate, or hydrogels that replicate soft tissue. And it's now more and more that engineers come into the field and putting it like an architecture behind it, a design behind it. For example, DARPA funded a project called the fracture putty. It's like a toothpaste.
Uh-huh.
So a physician, if they have a defect, would bring this toothpaste out, mold it, put it in there. It cures, becomes solid, and the person can stand up and walk. That's the idea.
So it's sort of capping your tooth as you sit there in the chair.
Yeah.
It's not your tooth. It's something much more crucial.
But all of these approaches so far have failed because it's a paste-like material, and when it cures, it has a random architecture. You cannot control where the portions are and how the architecture is formed.
But it's still porous.
It's still porous.
Right. So, I mean, it's formulated to begin with so that it will still biodegrade.
Yeah.
Not
and
like
it's
stuff
a composite.
In your teeth.
It has to be a composite,
right.
Meaning you have to have particles in it, and you have to have a slur or a soft material that then becomes solid. And you have to have enough particles in it that the particles touch each other. So when they degrade, they build a porous network. You need to have what's called an open porous network for tissue to grow in, have blood vessels kind of growing into that network to build bone tissue. And that's the problem. You need about 60 to 80% porosity for this to happen. If you have a random architecture of 60, 70% porosity, the material is absolutely brittle and falls apart.
Okay.
What we do is we design the architecture. Like for a building, you have structural beams that go in certain directions to carry the load. And then we build the architecture using, for example, stereolithography, rapid prototyping techniques to build these. And they're about 500 times stronger than these random architectures using the same building material.
So it's the same building material regardless of the replacement target?
No, for the same application.
Right.
So instead of using this paste-like material for bone tissue, we use the same materials, but we build engineered structures out of it.
You need to have something that has the strength. You need to have something that is compatible with the tissue that's going to grow on it. And talk a little bit, I mean, the strength part we can understand, that's normal engineering and so on. But how do you determine that this particular thing that you're making will actually allow the tissue to grow on it?
I guess there are different factors that play a role in it. One of them is the surface environment where the tissue is attached to. So you can have different type of coatings on the surface that attract the cells. But one thing that we're also working on is that you have the right, what we call mechanical environment, the right mechanical surface environment. Tissue can only grow in an environment where you allow it to behave like a natural tissue. If you have a very soft polymer, for example, that's much softer than bone tissue, you will never get bone tissue. Because at the same load that you experience, for example, if you have an upper thigh bone that you need to replace a portion of, you experience the same load even if you have a soft material or a hard material in it. But the soft material is going to deform a lot more than the hard material. So if the bone cells that want to grow into this polymer get deformed a lot more than they would do in a natural bone tissue, you will get fibrous tissue and not bone tissue.
I mean, the reason I ask this, I remember that the blood is supersaturated with respect to phosphate. But it doesn't precipitate everywhere. It only precipitates in these areas which are prepared in the collagen areas of the bone because there's something that signals there and says, okay, precipitate calcium hydroxyapatite here. And so I'm just wondering how you deal with that problem where the blood comes in and says, oh, this is the right spot to precipitate the mineral.
I think part of the process that we want to pursue is we design a fluid channel system into the architecture. So the architecture is designed first for the mechanical support, and the second aspect is for angiogenesis, for having blood vessels kind of growing into it. So no matter how large the implant is, you will have blood perfusion throughout the implant because you design a fluid network through the implant.
Yeah, but I think the question Russ is getting at is that you've got to have the coating, as you put it, has got to be very specific for the particular need that you have. So you've got to put something in there that recognizes, like it's got to be a receptor, for example. You deal with biochemists to sort of, the coatings must be very specific, and that's where a lot of really clever science must come in.
Yeah, correct. And this whole process is more or less an interdisciplinary process. So you have to have, for example, clinicians in there that look at the surgical approach. You have to have engineers in there that look at the architectures. You have to have biochemists in there that look into the material properties and material surface coatings. And
The lawyers, just to
the
make
lawyers,
sure
yeah.
that, you know, you don't screw up too badly, right?
Well, I mean, but there's more to it than that. It's a fascinating subject. I mean, if you come up with a new material, you have to get it tested in humans or tested somehow. Are there any tests prior to human implantation? And what do you have to do to get permission to put it into a person?
That's a good question. And part of it is actually that this whole area used to be that you just developed something, a tissue replacement material, and you put it in a human. But the field is converting this idea also to other applications. For example, you built a construct that you can look at how pathology develops. You can look into building a tissue analog where you can test different type of drugs in it in a bioreactor setting instead of using an animal. And because it's engineered and fabricated, you have quality control and you can replicate it in a standardized fashion and replicate the same experiment that otherwise would be difficult in an animal model. And then you can look at different diagnostics, different type of drugs, and like I said, also the pathology itself. So you develop models outside an animal in a bioreactor system where you can test it and use the same fabrication techniques.
Well, do you think our system here for proving this type of thing has gotten too complicated?
I think everybody would agree to, because if you have any type of polymer system in there, right now the FDA requires that every single fabrication step in order to get the polymer converted into a solid structure need to be verified with toxicity tests and everything else. And so far, I guess, except for a few polymers, none of the ones that are currently in research have ever made it into a clinic.
You mean by each step? I go back. You mean each chemical step
that
is
reaction,
performed
correct.
To see if there's side products that might linger
yeah.
that then could cause problems later on?
Because you could have residue of any of the chemical right. compounds that are still saturated somewhere.
Well, you know, for me as the patient, at this stage of my life anyway, I said, well, thank God for that.
Russell would shot.
Well, no. The other way around. I mean, Europeans are very, well, in England, we're very cognizant of the big problem with thalidomide many, many years ago, 40, 50 years ago. And it was only in North America where that was not a problem because that particular material had not been given FDA approval or whatever the agency was in those days. And so that caution, I think, is totally warranted. But, I mean, Russell would disagree with
it. Yeah, I disagree, and in a fair and balanced approach here. One of the things that concerns me about this is that there's a lot of evidence that we do all this research, very beautiful research and application like you're doing, but we're losing our competitiveness to other countries that make it much easier to try this stuff. And I, for one, do not want to lose our competitiveness.
And I completely agree, and it actually goes a lot further than not just investigating new materials, but also even using existing material. There is a polymer called PCL, or polycaprolactic, that is a biodegradable polymer that's used for sutures in a clinic, and a lot of us want to use this for tissue engineering applications. There are only two companies in the world that manufacture PCL medical grade. If you contacted them and you want to buy this material, and you coming from a medical institution, you won't be able to buy it.
And quickly, the reason?
They're afraid of being sued. If that ever makes it into a patient,
okay, so
hunts
that
them
goes
back
to breast implants and silicones.
You can
all
write
those
them
things.
Letters of the wazoo telling you that this is just research. We'll never use it for any medical applications in a patient, and it's just pure in a laboratory setting. It won't help. You won't get them.
Well, that seems like an opportunity, but we'll come back in one moment. You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Kinelli, and Michael Liebchner from the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. An Academy Award-winning biopic on Stephen Hawking has made us ask again how the physicist has lived so long with ALS.
Most people with ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease die 3 to 5 years from the onset of symptoms. Scientists have spent years trying to understand its cause. Neurons that control voluntary movement die in ALS patients until even breathing is impossible.
90 to 95% of all cases are not inherited. Three causes being studied are chemical imbalance, disorganized immune response, and gene mutation. A recent study indeed identified a new mutated gene in about 2% of ALS patients.
The finding results from the largest gene sequencing of ALS to date and involved nearly 3,000 patients and 6,400 control subjects. It took a study of this size to detect such a rare gene variant.
The gene, tank-binding kinase 1, or TBK1, is involved in a cell system that degrades and recycles waste. Scientists are trying to link mutations in the gene with accumulation of protein aggregates that's killing neurons.
TBK1 is also important in the immune response. Scientists have long thought inflammation in the brain plays a role in ALS. Since TBK1 tamps down inflammation, a mutation in the gene could interfere with that function.
Researchers are also studying a gene, optin, that interacts with TBK1. Together, they regulate cell waste disposal and inflammation. Scientists are experimenting on mice engineered with mutations in both genes to determine how they contribute to ALS.
Since ALS can be caused by dozens of gene mutations, the more we discover, the better chance we have of understanding their pathway to disease.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discovery shaped the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pennell, Russ Chinelli, Michael Liebschner from the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. And we're talking about robotic intraoperative procedures. What do you envisage as a sort of the ultimate goal of this business, the holy grail, if I could put it that way?
Actually, developing an affordable system, a cost-effective system for building artificial organs. And through collaboration with other people, what we discovered as the holy grail is, for example, artificial kidneys, where there's a high shortage of people dying, being on a waiting list, and only about 4% of all people that decease a year qualify as a donor. And there's nothing else available right now. And I mean, people on dialysis, it helps them, but it still does not improve their health.
So but that sounds like a fairly complicated thing to do. I mean, what does the kidney do? It separates different components that you want to get out of the body. So how do you design an artificial kidney?
We don't know yet. We need funding for it.
So that's the holy grail, right?
That's the biggest problem. Is actually biofabrication, or the field of biofabrication, is completely unfunded right now. There's almost no government institution that funds this area. It's dominated by biochemists that have been doing tissue engineering for many, many years, and this is a new area and it's been completely neglected.
Do you think that you could actually design an artificial kidney? I mean, okay, a heart is a pump. You know, that seems at some level simpler, right, than a kidney. I don't know.
I don't know either.
Well, we do have artificial, we do have potential artificial heart pumps right now.
Yeah.
But are there any artificial kidney prospects out there?
Well, obviously not, because,
not
I mean, that's what he's saying.
No.
But, I mean, have we made any artificial bioimplant that you can actually say, hey, we've got that technology down pat?
Actually, I think there's a kind of a blurb in terminology. For example, people use the term artificial organs already, mm-hmm. and they have been implanted in humans, except these are existing organs from donors that have been decellularized. So, I mean, all the living material is taken out, and then the patient's own cell has been seeded onto it, and they call it artificial organ. But it actually has been an organ from the beginning and then just manipulated.
Haven't they actually transplanted the pig hearts? I mean, isn't that something where you take a heart from an animal? I thought that was tried somewhere.
Yeah, but I mean, again, that begs the question because that's a pre-existing unit.
Yeah, but
what we're talking about is
nose-changing shape after a while.
Yeah, but when you think of diseases like, the H1N1 type of virus and these type of things that are transmitted from animals onto humans, if you take an animal and you actually take the biological material of an animal, you could have a whole bunch
right.
of other type of problems associated with that.
So apart from bone, you know, I mean, titanium implants and things like this type of synthesis that you're doing with biodegradable polymers as a template that will disappear but then create finally the unit that you're looking for. Where are we in that? What can you say now is actually being used in clinical trials or animal trials?
None of it has been used so far.
Okay, so
and
this
the,
is a
the
completely...
The advances that have been made in that field are not far enough yet.
Okay.
I mean, we built our system since last summer, so there's not a whole lot that has been done in this
area. You know, this will take me in a different direction. You, as an engineer, how do you view this project? And what I mean by that is... you know, you could think of two things, saving lives, and you could also think of making money. Which way do you think about it? Or maybe both?
I would say both, because I started a company before with a colleague of mine on, for example, diagnostic tools for osteoporosis. Osteoporosis is going to be that number one disease that's going to cripple our healthcare system, because it, once you're diagnosed, it requires a lifelong treatment, and there's no cure for it. If you can diagnose very early on, you actually increase the quality of life of the patients, and you might need minimal intervention, just a few or minor medication, maybe a change in lifestyle that can overcome that disease, instead of diagnosing too late when you already have a fracture or the bone mass is already so drastically reduced that you're at high risk of developing fractures. And what we did is we developed a technique that uses direct mechanical assessment of the tissue instead of taking pictures. It's like when you have, after an earthquake, and you have to assess if a building is still strong enough for people to live in.
So you actually do sort of a stress test on the bone.
Yeah. What we use is acoustic vibrations or structural dynamics. That's the engineering field.
And that's non-invasive?
That's non-invasive,
so you can just run this instrument.
It sounds like a great idea. What happened to the company?
It's kind of dormant right now, mainly because it takes so many clinical trials in order to get it through. And the hurdle for getting like angel investors or any type of investment in order to move this forward into prototypes that it can use in the clinic, is the threshold is so high right now that you need serious connections in order to achieve that. So
yeah.
It's just, and
okay.
Houston, the venture capital is not there yet by now.
But you hit the nail on the head when you said that this will cripple any sort of health plans that the nation never comes up with, apart from the one that we have now. And so that would be something where you would expect federal funding to be key, because that's the group in the end that's going to, we as a society are going to benefit the most. And I don't quite understand why that wouldn't be something that was high on NIH sort of funding list.
We kind of see this in other areas too, that most practical applications are not funded. If you do something with stem cells and nanoparticles, you get all the funding in the world.
Yeah, this is where I was going with this
things
issue.
Things that might never make it into a clinic get funded.
And the other issue here is
meow.
And we've had this before when we interviewed a lady on Diabetes One, Lynn Faustman. The issue was she came up with something entirely different. And the way I explain that is she was with the consensus scientists, she broke their rice bowls, okay, because it was so new and effective, their funding was not as effective for what they were doing. So you always have to look out there if you come up with something new. You're going to take some other people out of business, and they don't like that. So they may give you bad reviews.
I have a very good example for that. I'm involved in a research project at Orthopedics Department at Baylor College of Medicine with the medical examiner in Houston and our neurosurgery department. And it looks into the risk of sustaining a spinal cord injury after a traffic accident, particularly about the standard care causing spinal cord injury, not the accident itself. So after an accident, you may have a ruptured ligament or some instability in the spine, but the first thing first aid responders do is put a neck collar on it. What the neck collar does, it stretches your head away from the torso in order to stabilize the head. If you get the spinal instability, you actually stretch the spinal cord. And there have been several cases where patients refused to go to the hospital or in an ambulance car, so they walked in the hospital, being placed on an MRI scanner or a CT scanner, get the neck collar on to basically stabilize the head while the scans are being taken, then they're paralyzed. So this kind of started this whole research project in looking into how neck collars stretch heads and people that have been involved in car accidents. And we've done studies with the medical examiner in car fatalities to see how often that happens and how we can diagnose this. And then once we already have preliminary data, so we started submitting grant applications. And what you mentioned is exactly the case. Nobody gives anything about preventing injuries to happen in the first place. But if you can find a cure for spinal cord injuries, which may never happen, do you get all the funding in the world?
I mean, there's a logic to that at least,
and
there, right?
We predict that about 25% of all spinal cord injuries could have been prevented.
How do you make that prediction?
Based on observations in the hospital. Yeah.
I mean, 25% sounds right. It could be 10. right? I mean, I do this trick.
Still, every person that you could prevent from being paralyzed.
Hang on a minute, though. I mean, the point is then we have limited resources, all right? And since, you know, you say, well, maybe one out of 10, maybe it could be one out of 20. It could be, oh, well, the statistics weren't quite as clear as we did, or the reporting for the apocryphal story was less clinically correct than it should be. It may be only one in 40. There's a diminishing feature there. And, you know, I think it's reasonable for a government or an organization to say, we're going to put our money where we know that there's an issue until we've been demonstrated very unambiguously that the other issue is perhaps more or equally as important.
If you're in an accident or something, you should not put the collar on? Is that the idea?
In some cases. And the point is, how does the person who's been trained at minimal level ever going to know what is...
Look, because an ambulance car does not have a diagnostic tool.
Yeah. Well, anyway, look, I mean, one of the issues is, for all the fact that there are big problems with the medical system all over the world, everybody's living longer, healthier. We're doing quite well.
But I think
but
that it, go back
there's
to
actually the problem.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Our body is not built to last our life expectancy. Our body is built to last about 45 years. Everything else is done through medical advances.
Well, wait a minute. I don't know that that's true. I mean, the life expectancy in England 100 years ago wasn't 45 years, and we didn't have very much medical whatever.
No,
whatever.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that your life expectancy is your body health. Your body is built to last about 45 years.
So after 45 years, what you're saying, people start getting big issues with the problems.
Your peak health, your peak bone health, for example, is at age 25, 27. After that, it goes downhill.
Then if you really follow that logic, it's simply because we're not doing the right things to maintain our body. And maybe that's what medical research should all be about.
Well, let me interrupt here.
Oh, now, hang on,
because
we've had this before.
There's a study that tells you this, and it was done in England, started in England, it still goes on. In 1946... There was a program started in England to watch through the life of people how the childhood affected their age.
Right.
These people are now 65, and they're still in the program. And the people that had good childhoods and that their parents took care of them in the proper way lived longer than people that had problems in their childhoods.
I totally believe it, but it doesn't. You don't help us by saying had the proper childhood. What was this? Deprivation. I was deprived of sugar all my life until I got away from home at 18.
Well,
right?
I mean, these are all I'm saying.
Deprivation?
All I'm saying is when you ask these questions, you need to include all of the science. Okay? And deprivation can mean, you know, not the right food, not to. Yeah. But when you talk about extending your life, you got to start with a good childhood.
Yeah, but look, they've done these experiments now. Our expectancy, what was it, about 5 years ago, these people in biology or some area of health-related science put a bet down, right? They each put away, I think, $50 or $100 a month forever, the two of them. And then by the time of 100 years from now, or was it 150? The winner of this, all this money that's accumulated, will be the one that says, look, I believe that there are going to be people alive in 150 years in good health, you know, that were born on the day of the bet. And I think people understand that's just naturally going to happen. And that's a problem.
I mean, we do have different body parts that don't regenerate. The brain does not regenerate. The lungs don't regenerate. So there are a lot of different tissues that don't regenerate. And if they fall apart... To fall apart.
I think this has fallen apart. Actually, we got lost somewhere, didn't we?
I think it was a very interesting
fascinating discussion. Anyway, Michael, thank you for being here on Science Studio. And Russell, why don't you say goodbye?
Yeah, thanks, Michael, for being here in Science Studio. Michael Liebschner from the College of Medicine at Baylor.
It's great fun. And out there in the audience, come back next week, another Science Studio. I hope we all live that long. Bye-bye. Thank you.